from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Ukraine's president has accused Russia of invading the eastern part of the country, a claim which has been strongly denied by Moscow. The claim comes as a powerful counteroffensive by anti-government forces in Ukraine's eastern regions is inflicting heavy losses on Ukrainian troops. RT's Paula Slyer reports from Donetsk in East Ukraine.
What we are hearing are strong words from the Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko. He has accused Russia of invading Ukraine. He has cancelled a trip to Turkey. He's also calling for an emergency meeting of the United Nations Security Council.
Today, because of the escalation of the situation in the Donetsk region and because of the factual invasion of Ukrainian territory by the Russian army, I have decided to cancel my visit to Turkey.
Now, there is a rally that is taking place in Kyiv as Poroshenko makes these comments. People are demanding and protesting against the authorities, calling for the dismissal of the country's defense minister. Russia has repeatedly denied that it is providing any kind of military assistance or troops to the anti-Kyiv protesters here in eastern Ukraine. But what is particularly interesting is the timing of Poroshenko's comments. They come as the Ukrainian military suffers defeat after defeat. It needs to be pointed out that these anti-government fighters have been on the offensive for quite some time and are reclaiming captured towns. At the same time, it's not the first time we're hearing these kind of claims. What we do know is that for some time, the anti-government forces have said that they have received assistance, but from Russian volunteers. Take a listen.
There were 3,000 to 4,000 of them among us. Many of them have already left home. Even more are still here. Unfortunately, some have been killed. Many of those Russian volunteers are former soldiers.
Now, a few days ago, there were 10 Russian soldiers who mistakenly crossed over the Russian-Ukrainian border into Ukrainian territory. The incident happened at night, and while at a part of the border where there are very few signposts, different allegations were put forward that Russian paratroopers who were allegedly killed in Ukraine have now been buried in several Russian cities. Now, the Russian president's office says it is looking into these allegations, but there hasn't been any kind of independent verification at this stage. It is important also to note that on several different occasions, there have been Ukrainian troops who have crossed over into Russia. They have been seeking some kind of assistance, and then they've always returned back to Ukraine.
British journalist Tony Gosling said that the claims of Russian involvement follow a number of previous accusations made by Kyiv against Russia that have been proven false. He fears that a proxy war between the West and Russia is taking place on the ground in Ukraine and that it could pose a serious threat, including possible nuclear war.
If you keep repeating the same thing, people think, oh, well, Russians must be in there. We keep hearing this, even though if you actually look into it at the end, it turns out to be a lie. The question, of course, is about, you know, are the democracies in the West really democracies? We've got a situation now in Iraq and Afghanistan where, you know, Tony Blair sent the troops in, George Bush sent the troops in to put in supposed democracy. Both countries now, complete stalemate with the incumbent governments refusing to acknowledge elections. So there's no democracy we're spreading around the world. And I question, you know, how strong is our democracy here too? You know, where we have our politicians really in a stranglehold by the banks, by debt, and they're completely tied up, I'm afraid, with you know, with dealing with that debt crisis. And what happens when there's a bit of a power vacuum like that is the military will come in. People will say, well, no one wants a war. Actually, some people will make a lot of money out of a war. And the problem, of course, is we're coming to a sort of Cuba-style situation from the 1960s, the Cuban Missile Crisis, where you've got NATO coming, approaching right up to the Russian border, and the potential for a nuclear war even possibly there, you know, is almost being ignored. It's not really being seriously considered.
China and the U.S. are holding high-level talks in Washington as tensions there have almost resulted in direct military contact between U.S. and Chinese forces near China's airspace. We have this from the Chinese news agency CCTV.
Chinese and U.S. military officials are holding 2 days of talks in Washington to negotiate a code of conduct on the high seas. This comes in the wake of a Chinese fighter jet having a so-called close encounter with a U.S. surveillance plane near China's Hainan Island. Although the meeting was set up before this incident, it is believed that the near miss will make a difference during the negotiations. And CCTV correspondent Nathan King has more.
Talks have been previously scheduled and stem from a meeting between Chinese President Xi Jinping and US President Barack Obama back in March. That's when both agreed on the need for an early formulation of a code of conduct between both militaries when it comes to the issues of airspace and international waters. However, last week's so-called close encounter in the South China Sea has brought perhaps more urgency to the talks. The US says one of its P-8 Poseidon surveillance planes was buzzed by a Chinese J-11 fighter jet. The US Defense Department complained that the Chinese jet at one point came within 9 meters of the surveillance craft and performed a barrel roll and showed its weaponry. US officials have also said similar incidents occurred in March, April and May. Meanwhile, China rejects those accusations and says its jet was routinely dispatched to identify the aircraft. In the wake of the incident, Beijing is calling on Washington to end flights so close to China's shores, flights the US says are legal. However, China says military surveillance flights so close to its coast are provocative. Both countries say these kinds of misunderstandings can lead to escalation. Both China and the US have agreed on the need for a code of conduct.
It appears that the US is positioning itself for direct military action in Syria, where the official US-backed rebels, the so-called moderate opposition armed fighters, and other groups, such as the al-Nusra Front and the group known as ISIL, ISIS, and the Islamic State, have been fighting the Syrian government since February 2011. According to various news reports, there are unresolved issues among top national security officials in the U.S. that include the reliability of American intelligence on ISIL areas in Syria, what the goals and limits of airstrikes would be, and how any military action could be justified legally, politically, and diplomatically, absent a UN Security Council authorizing resolution. This follows reports that dead Americans are showing up among the casualties being taken by ISIL. We have this report from RT.
Washington estimates as many as 300 Americans are now fighting with the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq. They could potentially pose a huge risk to U.S. security if they return from war zones and use skills learned abroad to carry out attacks at home. In fact, it's been confirmed that a 33-year-old American who had joined the ranks of the jihadists was killed in battle over the weekend in Syria. A guy in H. Jacan now reporting on Washington's sudden realization.
The U.S. president has diagnosed the Islamic State.
Rooting out a cancer like ISIL won't be easy and it won't be quick.
Many are asking if the cancer could have been caught at an earlier stage when the Islamic State group, as part of the Syrian opposition, was gaining momentum in the country and when rich donors in Gulf states were funding and arming the group. But until recently, the West seemed more preoccupied with toppling the Syrian president.
We will work with like-minded states to support the Syrian opposition to hasten the day when Assad falls.
The European Union has agreed to bring to an end the arms embargo on the Syrian opposition.
We are constantly consulting with the opposition on how they can get organized so that they're not splintered and divided in the face of the onslaught from the Assad regime.
For years, the White House tried to present a picture of the Syrian opposition as consisting of, quote, former farmers and teachers.
Some within the intelligence community had a really big red flag go up that was alarming the administration and elected officials that the problem in Syria was bigger than anybody anticipated. But the problem is that the elected officials chose to have a moment of dumb and dumber and hear what they wanted to hear. So you had John McCain patrolling the streets of Aleppo thinking that supporting the insurgents was a good idea.
One thing the West perhaps failed to see was the blurred lines between the moderate and the radical groups within the Syrian opposition.
ISIS, until very recently, was part of a broad Sunni group in Syria that was being supplied by the United States.
The extremist group makes use of modern technologies like no other radical organization. They even use surveillance drones to plan attacks on the Syrian military. The question arises whether the U.S. has misjudged the scale of extremism in Syria as it focused all efforts on bringing down the Syrian government.
you ask for so much cooperation, but it ended up all the help you got from America ended up being with us now, alhamdulillah, for free. They lost in Iraq, they lost in Afghanistan. They're going to lose in Syria also, inshallah, when they come. We'll be waiting for them, inshallah, to take more ghanima from them.
The Islamic State group is now cheering about all the arms and money that they have seized, both in Iraq and in Syria. ISIS sympathizers are posting pictures on Twitter in U.S. cities with a message saying, "We are in your streets."
In Washington, I'm Ganesh Chagan, RT.
Meanwhile, as the fighting continues, Syrians themselves are experiencing a massive humanitarian catastrophe. Derek Mbata reports from the United Nations.
People continue to suffer as a result of the ongoing conflict in Syria, where the social and economic fabric of the country has been ripped to shreds. That's what the UN Deputy Humanitarian Chief, Kyung Hwa Kang, said during her briefing to the Security Council on Thursday. More than 190,000 people are reported to have died in the conflict, and Ms. Kang said that number might even be higher. She pointed out that it has been 6 months since the Council adopted a resolution aimed at pressing the parties to the conflict in Syria to reduce the suffering of ordinary people caught up in the conflict.
Over the past 6 months, the plight of people in Syria has not been reduced but has deepened. The violence and conflict continues unabated, with more deaths of women, children, and men. The social and economic fabric of the country has been ripped to shreds. According to data collected by human rights organizations from various sources, July 2014 was particularly harrowing since the start of the conflict for civilians in Syria, with over 1,000 civilian deaths and injuries.
Ms. Kang also told the Security Council that for the first time in 6 months, there was some improvement on humanitarian access in July. She said that as a result of a resolution adopted by the Council, relief agencies are now reaching more people in need in hard-to-reach areas. Derek Mbata, United Nations.
Libya is the North African nation which once boasted the highest standard of living on the continent, but now lies in ruins, a shattered, failed state that has languished in a condition of desperate poverty and civil war since the 8-month U.S.-led NATO bombing campaign began in March 2011. Libya was the subject of an emergency meeting at the UN Wednesday.
Since my last briefing to the Council on July 17th, armed battles, inflamed by air strikes, continued almost uninterrupted in Tripoli, Benghazi, and other parts of the country. In Tripoli, we have seen an unprecedented movement of population in an attempt to escape the fighting. Conservative figures for those displaced are estimated at over 100,000, with at least another 150,000, including many migrant workers, have sought refuge abroad and fled the country. There is a general deterioration of living conditions. Food, fuel, water and electricity are in short supply. The departure of foreign medical staff and shortages in medical supplies has rendered the plight of civilians more critical. A risk in criminality has contributed to a further worsening of the situation. It is also likely that the fighting will result in the dissemination of explosive remnants of war and unexploded ordnances, posing a further threat to civilians. The use by all sides of heavy weapons in densely populated areas has spread terror and contributed to a rising toll of innocent lives lost, including children. In addition, there have been many cases of kidnapping, burning houses, looting, and other acts of revenge. The damage inflicted on public installations in Tripoli's southern and western sections, including the airport, the main oil depot, roads and bridges, is nothing less than tragic. In the east, Fighting continues between two coalitions of forces comprising Libya Shield's units, armed brigade, and the Ansar Sharia extremist group on one hand, and forces allied to General Khalifa Haftar and the army special forces on the other. The violence has resulted in a significant number of civilian casualties.
That was Tariq Mitri, Special Representative and Head of the United Nations Support Mission in Libya, or UNSMIL, reporting to the UN Security Council on Wednesday as the Council unanimously approved a resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire and sanctions against some of the parties involved in violence there. Ibrahim Debashi is the permanent representative of Libya to the United Nations. At the time that the U.S. and its allies set their sights on Libya, Debashi was among a handful of Libyan government officials whose coordinated public defections made it appear through the lens of Western media that the state itself was collapsing from within in the face of protest. Ambassador Debashi was appointed as the deputy ambassador to the UN only a month before Libya's troubles began. Shortly after his appointment, he made the following statements at a press conference at the UN on March 16, 2011, a day before the Security Council authorized the no-fly zone resolution, which the U.S. interpreted to permit NATO airstrikes, which began on March 21st and continued into November.
I just want to tell you that we think that Colonel Gaddafi today has lost his mind after he saw that the National Army, which is the Revolution Army, is started to using fighter jets in attacking his security battalions. Because he started now preparing for two major operations, according to the information we get. Colonel Gaddafi has gathered a large number of mercenaries of those who were fighting in the civil war in Congo and in Uganda and maybe Rwanda and Burundi, and also mercenaries from Niger and Chad. And they are led by a Libyan general whose name is Ali Kanna At-Targi. Now they are moving toward Sijdabia in more than 400 vehicles. We expect them to arrive soon to Sijdabia. Sijdabia, as you know, is under siege, and the fighting is in Sijdabia since yesterday, and the forces of the regime could not take it. So he is bringing these mercenaries, a large force of mercenaries. The information we get that they have clear instructions. Destroy everything and kill whoever you find in Sijdabia. And don't spare any lives, don't spare any buildings. We think that in the future, and in the coming hours, we will see a real genocide in Sijdabia if the international community does not move quickly and prevent him from attacking it with a large force. And I think the international community has to act very quickly, and it has to destroy his forces before it get into the mountain and start killing people on according to their race. We are hopeful that the Libyan people is looking forward to the Security Council to adopt a resolution as soon as possible and to authorize air strikes on the forces of Colonel Gaddafi, especially those forces which has a clear intention, which is to destroy villages either in the western side of Libya or in Sijdabia.
As it turned out, after the no-fly resolution, Resolution 1973, was passed the following day, the claims that enabled it, that the Jamahiriya government of Gaddafi had launched air attacks on protesters and that the Libyans had brought in black mercenaries from across Africa, were both proven false. Nevertheless, 5 days later, President Obama made this announcement.
Today, I authorized the armed forces of the United States to begin a limited military action in Libya in support of an international effort to protect Libyan civilians. That action has now begun.
7 months later, on October 20th, 2011, the man Libyans considered the father of modern Libya, Muammar Gaddafi, was captured and killed after 7 months of deadly massive bombing by the U.S. and NATO, in conjunction with thousands of foreign fighters from al-Qaeda and other militant groups on the ground. One day prior to Gaddafi's killing, U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton made an unannounced visit to the country. We have this report from that time from RT.
During her unannounced visit to Libya, U.S. Chief Diplomat Hillary Clinton stated that Washington hopes to see ousted leader Colonel Gaddafi captured or killed.
The following day, upon hearing of Gaddafi's death, Clinton had this to say.
We came, we saw, he died.
Did it have anything to do with your visit?
At the time of the ambassador's defection in February of 2011, Libya had universal home ownership. Everyone owned their own homes, free of mortgages, taxes, rents, or other payments. Healthcare was universal and free, and could be used by any Libyan at any facility in the world. Education was universal and free, and could be used by any Libyan at any educational facility in the world that accepted them, with the government also paying for room and board for family members. Libyans got a monthly check from the country's oil revenues, and food, energy, and other necessities were universally available and either free or heavily subsidized. 9 months after Ambassador Dabashi defected in New York before the TV cameras, that was all gone. Instead, the country was leveled, its former population of 6 million shrunk to 4 million, and, as in Iraq and Syria, a period of poverty and war began that has escalated to the point now that the UN is again taking the matter up. This is what Ambassador Dabashi had to say to the Security Council this past Wednesday.
I would just like to say that I don't know why the Libyan delegation was not invited to participate in part of the session and why the Libyan delegation did not take its place at the table during the time when this resolution was adopted. Is this a new practice adopted by the council, a council that was unanimously adopted, or is it a decision that was taken by the president of the council or the secretariat? Indeed, I don't know why you adopted this practice. Is there some specific message that's being sent by the president or the council to the Libyan delegation? There are many strong voices in the media who speak loudly but only disseminate rumors, incite to violence, and they falsify the facts. There are many voices that belong to people who have dual nationality. These are well-known people who live abroad. They live outside the country with their families. And these people are not interested in those who lost their lives. They're not interested in the destruction wrought. They're only interested in what they have to gain personally. Mr. President, there is an enormous need to help Libyans and to disarm, especially with heavy weaponry. It's the only way to stop the carnage and to save the lives of those people who have been used by the political powers. They are using these people to feed this dirty war, which goes against all moral principles and religious principles. It is a way to stop this war from being used in the cities to prevent displacement of persons internally, which we've seen in recent weeks. And I believe that the only choice before the armed groups at this time, if they want to be able to lead a normal life and if they want to have any kind of future, they have but one choice, and that is to respect the Council of Representatives' decisions to lay down their weapons. There are therefore two choices. First, the armed groups need to understand the need for organizing the army and the need for reform of the army. Secondly, these armed groups need to accept the visit of a Muslim and Arab force, which would be limited in number to take the weapons back and to take them away to destroy them. And I believe that when the Council of Representatives appointed a general of the revolutionary ranks, this led to another cult within the army. I hope that all the armed groups will work together with the new general. So that they will leave the armed forces behind this staff general. Mr. President, the situation in Benghazi and in Tripoli has pushed the Council of Representatives to hold their meetings outside of these two cities. This is not against the constitutional declaration, which stipulates that the seat of the National Council is in Benghazi, but that the Council of Representatives can hold meetings in other cities. The international community must assist the Libyan government and the Council of Representatives so that they can have control over the state and Libyan territory. And this must be done by fighting terrorism, by disarming the armed groups. And we commend here the role played by countries in the region in order to assist the Libyan authorities to restore peace and stability. And we applaud the results of the meeting of foreign ministers of held on the 25th of August. The conclusion and final declaration of this meeting called for a number of actions. Number one, immediate cessation of armed conflict of the armed groups in order to enable the political process to unfold and to provide for political dialogue of all parties not engaged in violence to lead to reconciliation and to draft a new constitution for the country. The communique underscored the very important role to be played by countries in the region, including follow-up of the situation as it evolves in Libya and the importance of Libya participating in all regional and international initiatives to find a solution. Two, all militia and armed agents must lay down their weapons for a gradual disarmament. These groups must also exclude the military option in the context of political consensus, including all political parties, based on a mechanism that would be supported by countries in the region and therefore not engage in violence. Three, it underscores the importance of foreign parties refraining from exporting weapons and arms to illegal groups in Libya. And it stresses the importance of promoting oversight of airports and other ports of entry into Libya. Moreover, the Libyan state is the only to have asked import of weapons, and that was after accepting the Sanctions Committee actions. Four, it's important to dry up all sources of weaponry and stop all transnational organized crime activities and all illegal activities in the country. Five, promote the role of legitimate institutions, legitimate state institutions, including the Council of Representatives, establish state institutions, rehabilitate them, including the police and the army, and this can be done through specific programs in order to restore peace. The objective here is to lay the foundation for stability, peace, and to promote the goals of development.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.